I have written a TV show. I've written 8 episodes, all right, of a limited series.
This is breaking news.
Yeah, it is breaking news.
Holy shit. You just put the feel. Your agents are jerking off right now in the other room. They're like, he does?
Yeah.
100%.
After years of fine print contracts and getting ripped off by overpriced wireless providers, if we've learned anything, it's that there's always a catch. So when I heard that for a limited time, all Mint Mobile wireless plans are $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan, I thought, what's the catch? But after talking to them, it all made sense. There isn't one. Mint Mobile's secret sauce is that they sell wireless service online. They cut out the cost of retail stores and pass those sweet savings directly to you. Say bye-bye to your overpriced wireless plans, jaw-dropping monthly bills, and unexpected overages. Mint Mobile is here to rescue you with premium wireless plans starting at $15 a month. Just ask our very own Josh Zola, whose entire wireless production facility plan lifestyle has been completely revamped and overwhelmed by Mint Mobile savings. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/bears. That's mintmobile.com/bears. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/bears. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plans. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
Well, you guys know he's had a quintuple bypass. He had his kidney transplant. I know he just got what are they called? When you're amputated, you get the prosthetics. They're fit in for him now. So, Bert, I hope all that is going well. Sitting in for Bert today is our good buddy, Quentin Tarantino.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah,
thank
you're
you.
Sitting in for Bert, man.
Wait, you mean the Hitler guy?
The Hitler guy. Okay. Yeah, exactly.
I'm sitting in his seat. His ass print is right like there. Molding. His ass might be a little bigger than mine.
I think it's much bigger than yours. Also want to point out you have a new book out, mm-hmm. Cinema Speculation.
Right on.
I told you I've begun the audiobook. Mm-hmm. I think I might switch.
Exactly. Yeah, your stock went way down when you said that.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Probably wasn't the really best way to say hello.
Sorry. I just wanted to let you know that I was actually consuming the material.
I appreciate it.
You like movies so much, you make me feel like I maybe don't like movies. because like I always thought I liked movies. Then I hear you talk and I'm like, what the fuck, man? But you were exposed to like such a, I mean, this book is like a dive into
how I grew up.
Because everybody, I think fans of you, of movies in general, kind of knew the story of, Quentin worked at a video store.
Yeah, yeah.
And he really likes movies. Mm-hmm. And I've seen you in interviews, refer to other movies from the past. Like, it was clear that you were a real fan of cinema.
Yeah,
a cinephile. But this gets at you in from like the beginning, like how you, as a kid, you were being taken by your mother and going to movies all the time.
Well, it was interesting because when I first came up with the idea to write the book, the idea was more or less just a book of film analysis.
Mm-hmm.
So I would pick my idea, I thought, was like I pick a few films and then I would write about them. And that was just kind of more or less the idea. I wasn't expecting it to be quite as autobiographical as it became. But I figured it would be autobiographical to some degree.
Yeah.
Because if you're writing about movies personally, then you end up telling about yourself in it. I mean, one of my favorite critics is Pauline Kael, and they asked her, would she ever write her autobiography? And she goes, no, I've written my autobiography in every one of my reviews. It's just kind of spread out.
Oh, interesting.
So I kind of figured that would be the case. But then I ended up writing the first chapter. And I think that was my attempt to try to write an introduction to the book, and which details me in 69, 70, 71 being taken to a bunch of these new Hollywood films by my parents when I was 7 and 8 and 9. And when I finished that chapter, it was like I was aware enough thinking, okay, well, that's a pretty good chapter. All right, that's not an introduction. That's chapter one.
Yeah.
And then once I wrote that chapter, I realized, okay, this is the book now. This is the book. Now I'm going to still continue on doing writing about different films, but now all of a sudden it had a structure.
Sure.
That it didn't have before. They all had to be movie. You know, since I was writing about having seen them at a young age, they all had all the movies I wrote about. I had to have seen then.
Right.
I had to have seen in the 70s.
Not something you saw later.
Yeah. Nothing I discovered later.
Yeah.
Down the line, you know, and whether or not I discuss what it was like seeing it at 12 or 13 or 15, that remains to be seen. All right. But they all had to come from that area. I had to see it from there. And that kind of became the umbilical cord mm-hmm. that carried through the book leading to the last chapter, which is like the first chapter, another autobiographical movie watching thing that kind of takes me up to that point
right.
in my life.
Yeah, I mean, it's like you have like this savant like ability. I think when you talk about films, mm-hmm. like you can just cite movies, and like I think, I don't know, you growing up in this time frame uh-huh. was probably the best thing for the filmmaker that we know today, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
I mean, if it was a different era, you'd be a different guy.
Yeah, no. I'm absolutely, and there also is just this kind of really neat thing about the fact that if you go through the timeline of Mark Harris's book, which was Pictures of the Revolution, that kind of talked about the beginning of New Hollywood, it kind of officially starting, even though old Hollywood still was dominant, in 67 mm-hmm. with The Graduate and Bonnie and Clyde and those movies coming out in the heat of the night. So if that's the beginning of the revolution, and 68 and 69 are the years that the Revolutionary War between old Hollywood and new Hollywood was fought, then 1970 would be the year that the revolution was won.
Uh-huh.
Well, that all coincides with yeah. me first going to the movies.
Right.
My very first experience going to the movies. So my first, just me even knowing what a movie is and just kind of putting it all together is coinciding with like the greatest period of motion pictures in the history of America.
Yeah. Now I heard you, cause I heard you do this phenomenal breakdown of like why I believe 80s movies sucked. Mm-hmm. And then by comparison.
70s,
yes. Yeah. What's your analysis of, or your thought on current state of cinema?
It makes the 80s look fucking great.
I'm so happy.
As terrible as the 80s was.
Yeah.
Now, we never had it so good by comparison.
Yeah. I mean, like, most things come out and you're like, this is dog shit. I know we can't, like, shit on everybody who works on every film, even though that'd be fun. But there's so many bad movies. Like, movies are so bad.
Well, I'm not here as a filmmaker to throw any rocks current movies, but it does seem like we're living through another repressive time uh-huh. when it comes to cinema. The first really big repressive time was the 50s. Then we skipped a generation with the 60s. Even the yeah. first half of the 60s was basically just the 50s part two. Mm-hmm. But then we got the 70s, and then the pendulum had to swing back again
right.
for the 80s. And then the pendulum swung the other way again for the 90s. I mean, I lived through the 90s making movies in the 90s. I didn't consider the 90s the 70s part two, but right. it was.
It was in retrospect.
It was. Well, yeah. In retrospect, it yeah. absolutely was. I didn't think about it then.
Right.
And then, now the pendulum has swung this way again. I'm just waiting for the pendulum to swing back.
Me too. I just as a fan. This is what I have to ask you about, because mm-hmm. I'm a fan. So one thing I never had, I always love so much in your movies mm-hmm. is your writing. Mm-hmm. Dialogue and mm-hmm. the stories. They're so original and they're so fun. And, I saw Pulp Fiction when it came out in theaters mm-hmm. and I was in fucking, I don't know, I think I was a freshman and I was 14 uh-huh. and you're like, oh my God, this is crazy.
A freshman in high school?
Yes, mm-hmm. in high school. And one thing I was always curious about was, what was the reception of that script like originally when you, like, was it celebrated as a, oh my God, like, could they see what this movie would be? Or was it like, this is crazy, dude, you know? Like,
yeah, No, it wasn't actually.
It wasn't celebrated, or it wasn't.
It was. It wasn't the situation where like the whole industry was like, oh my God, this is the greatest thing ever.
Okay.
and they're lining up to do it. Because as a matter of fact, it was. We had a deal to make the movie at TriStar at the time, because I did it through Danny DeVito's production company, Jersey Films, and they had a setup situation at TriStar. And so, you know, and they paid me a lot of money to write the script. So I hand in the script, and then Mike Medavoy and all his TriStar executives, and then the Danny DeVito Jersey Films executives, we all get together to have a big meeting about it. So we're in this big conference room and whatever. And it becomes fairly clear Mike Medavoy's not really into it.
Really?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And, but, you know, to give him, to explain it with him a little bit, which, by the way, was sort of throwing me a bit for a loop, for the simple fact that, you know, I wanted to work, of all the studios, he was the one that I wanted to work with, that I maybe trusted the studio the most, because Mike Medavoy used to run Orion. And I loved the history of Orion movies. I thought they were fantastic. And, you know, I thought he was really, you know, I thought he was a great executive. And he was a great executive. All right. But it was towards the end of his little tenure. But the thing about it, though, was he had just gone to like a retreat that Bill Clinton was having with people in Hollywood and the media and pop culture. I might be misrepresenting this slightly, but it was something like that.
Okay.
And Clinton was haranguing the Hollywood people about the violence in movies.
Oh boy. Yeah. Yeah.
He was haranguing them about the violence in movies. He was haranguing them about permissive drug use. And then just, I mean, frankly, it's fucking strange, all right? You know, all the things you would imagine the right wing would be haranguing, okay? Clinton was guilting.
Hey, guys, let's tone it down.
Yeah, all his big Hollywood supporters about this. And, like, I think, like, really kind of scolding them.
Mm-hmm.
So Mike Medavoy comes back from that and reads Pulp Fiction.
That's perfect. Yeah.
So he's just sort of, you know, he's kind of not down with the whole thing, you know, and then none of his yes men or yes women are disagreeing to him, disagreeing with him. And so I remember the conversation, and this is not to goof on him. We're friendly whenever we bump into each other. I'm glad it worked out the way it worked out. But the thing about it, though, is I remember one of the things is so he's going through a list.
Yeah.
Of the grueling things, or what he considers the grueling things in the movie.
There's quite a few of those, if that's your criteria.
Yeah. So he's going through, you know, and so, I mean, it sounds like he's describing Ken Russell's The Devils or something. I mean, you know, not this comedy, all right, that I wrote.
Yeah.
And so when he gets to the end of it, you know, I go, well, Mike, did you think it was funny? He goes, what do you mean? It's a comedy.
Uh-huh.
Did you think it was funny? Well, I guess a little, you know. I go, well, it's a comedy, man. And then we talk a little bit more and a little bit more. And he goes, well, you know, Quentin, you say it's a comedy. And I'm watching the lead character shoot up heroin. And I really doubt that the audience is going to think that's funny.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, well, maybe not that moment, but I guarantee you, people are going to laugh. This is I'm guaranteeing you.
Yeah.
This will get not that moment per se, even though that actually moment does get a laugh.
Sure.
Where you get when John gets that smile you know, on his face, you know the heroine's working, the whole audience giggles.
Sure.
At that point, but it was just like, you know, he just didn't get it. He didn't get it. But you know, I have to say, though, there was an interesting thing, though. There was something I was always curious about, and I give him credit for giving me the answer to this. There was something I was always curious about, and I was able to finally ask somebody who knew, who could give me the right kind of answer. And he gave me the answer. Even if it made him look a little bad, he gave me the honest answer. So one of the things is, I think on the internet, there's a thing floating around about my wish list of the cast for Pulp Fiction.
Okay.
It's kind of floating around. It's not really what it was. okay. this list that's floating around. What that was, I remember my agent telling me, okay, well, here's the thing, Quinn. What you want to do is you want the studio to sign off
on the
things that you want.
Okay.
So if they sign off on it, then, you know, anything on that list, you have permission to do. Now, if they don't sign off it, then you have to negotiate it. And you have to talk to them about it. But anything like that, but anything that they finally agree to, you're good with. So then I took and I didn't know exactly who I wanted to play this part or that part or this part or that part. And so, so I wrote a giant list with a ton of names. I wanted to get them all pre-approved.
Sure.
And I didn't know if it's going to work out, if I would vibe with the person or if they would even do a good job, but I wanted to get them approved. So in case I did,
and this is an ambitious list, right? This is your second film.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And so it's ambitious that who you ended up doing it without even knowing what your list was.
Yeah, yeah. So it's kind of all over the place, but that was kind of the idea. I wanted to be able to explore it and go all over the place. But then I'm also really very opinionated. So it's sort of like something like, I think for Pumpkin and Honey Bunny, for instance, mm-hmm. I think it was one of those things where, okay, so for Pumpkin, we will offer the movie to Tim Roth.
Mm-hmm.
If Tim Roth turns it down, we will offer it to Christian Slater.
And this is how you're telling them this.
Well, yeah, it's written on the list.
Uh-huh.
And if he turns it down, we will offer it to Johnny Depp. And I think it was the same thing with Alabama. So we will offer it to Amanda Plummer. If she turns it down, we'll offer it to Patricia Arquette, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so
can I ask you before you answer this, though, before you take it further? Is it considered at the time, are you shooting too high? Or is it like perfectly normal for you to be targeting this talent at the time?
No, yeah, yeah. I mean, no, they could have done it.
It's perfectly reasonable.
I was a real hip cat.
Okay.
After Reservoir Dogs.
Okay. Well, yeah, of course.
Yeah, actors were really looking.
So it was reasonable, I'm saying.
Oh, no. I could, if I, especially if I was offering him the John Travolta role.
Sure.
Johnny Depp would have totally read the script.
Yeah,
and I'm not saying he would have said yes, but they would have considered it.
Sure. Okay.
And so, and also I'm working with the studio. This is like a big studio. All right. I got a studio behind me. This is not a little independent outfit. So, Mike Medavoy is looking at the list and goes, okay, well, let me just look at this list here. What you say? Okay. Let me give you how the order I would go. I mean, Tim Roth is a very fine actor, and I know you just worked with him on Reservoir Dogs, so I'm sure that there's a connection and a loyalty there. However, the order I would go in is we would offer it to Johnny Depp first. And then if he turns it down, then we would offer it to Christian Slater. And if he turns it down, I would find somebody else other than Tim Roth to offer it to. And then if we can't do that, then Tim Roth. And I go, okay, Mike, let me ask you a question. This is a question I've been dying, because I've heard these kind of stories before as far as Hollywood is concerned. And I've always had a question about this, and maybe you can answer it. Do you think Johnny Depp playing the role of Pumpkin in this movie, which is the opening scene and the closing scene, that's it. Do you think that will add that much to the box office take, him playing that role? And Mike Medavoy said, it won't add a dime. It would make me feel better, though.
And that summarizes how most studio executives are, essentially. Right?
Yeah, it's like, oh, we're doing chancy material. However, if I get these big name actors sign a board, okay, well, that's that gives us something to sell.
Yeah.
That gives us something to sell. And also we have compadres on this. They like it. They're responding to it. They give us a bit of cover.
Yeah. And then I get to, as the studio executive, I get to go, Well, I did a pretty reasonable thing.
That's exactly it. If it all blows up, hey, I did my best.
Yeah, I got Johnny Depp.
Yeah, I got Johnny Depp. I got Patricia Arquette. I got Jennifer Jason Leigh doing this thing. Yeah. You know, I mean, I covered my ass the best I could.
How was casting? Because I've always, I mean, you know, the film is obviously an incredible film. Mm-hmm. Bruce Willis. He's great. He's so great in it. Right,
That ended up being a very interesting story. I mean, we weren't going out to Bruce Willis. I mean, that just seemed, I mean, especially at that time, I mean, he was one of the top five, if not even three, biggest stars in the world.
Yeah. It's a surprise when you first see the film, you're like, Bruce Willis is in it? You get shocked almost.
Absolutely. You know, and you know, I mean, he was definitely popular in America, but I mean, you go to Korea he's the man.
He's the man. Yeah.
And so what happened was I originally wrote the part for Matt Dillon because Matt Dillon was a fan of my script for Reservoir Dogs. And part of the thing, though, so TriStar is long since gone. We've made the deal with Miramax. And part of the thing about Miramax was, what was the deal? We have an ensemble cast, but we needed a Miramax, at least one approved, if not two, approved Miramax actors in the cast. And then from that point on, okay, you can cast anybody you want, as long as they had one of their, you know, somebody they considered a name that they could sell. And so Matt Dillon kind of fell into the name category that they would accept.
Okay.
So I wrote it for Matt, and it kind of seemed like it was going to be easy peasy getting him. But he read it and he wasn't so sure about it. He liked it, but he wasn't quite so sure. He was disturbed by the fact that there wasn't actually, like, he wanted to see Butch actually boxing. You know, he was really, I want to see the fight. And there's even a little bit, maybe he didn't 100% get it. Mm-hmm. All right. And this happened a lot. Okay. And he didn't want to play that part. He wanted to play the Vincent character.
All
right. That was almost all the way down the line. Anytime I offered somebody a part, they wanted to play somebody else.
Sure.
So he didn't say no, but he didn't say yes. So he still has to think about it.
Okay.
And that was a little scary because I thought he was in the bag.
Right.
And with him in the bag, I had a go movie.
Okay.
And now all of a sudden I didn't have such a go movie anymore.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So I'm like, holy shit. So in the meantime, Harvey Keitel, who's in the movie, and he was one of the guys. So I had him, he was shooting in town. When he was shooting in town, he'd usually, rent a house in Malibu. And so he would invite friends to come over for the weekend and hang out.
Jesus.
And so, like, I came over and I'm hanging out at Harvey's place. And then, well, it turns out that Bruce Willis was only living about three or four or five houses down the way.
Okay.
And so I come over to Harvey's and I'm there and some other people are there. And there's Bruce Willis. I've never met him before.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out he's a huge fan of Reservoir Dogs.
Okay.
Huge fan. And like he goes, like, if I had read Reservoir Dogs, I would have been in Reservoir Dogs. I would have agreed to do it, you know. And he goes, well, it's one of my favorite. Me and my buddies watch it a bunch of times. We know the dialogue by heart. We do the dialogue with each other. Wow. That's
awesome.
Amazing. Yeah. And I think it was one of those situations where he told Harvey that, you know, sometime earlier, you know, a couple of days earlier. And he goes, well, you know, you should look at Quentin's got a new script out there. Might be something you might like in it. And then he's going to be coming by on Sunday, you know, to hang out. So if you want to say hello to him, you know, that would be a good time. And that's exactly what Bruce did. So Bruce called up his agent. Hey, get me that damn Tarantino script. I want to read it. So little did I know, he had already read Pulp Fiction by the time I show up at Harvey's house that Sunday. And so we're all having a good time and we're all talking. And then he goes, hey, Quentin, take a walk with me. I'm going to take you to my house. I'm going to introduce you to Demi. All right, let's take a walk to my place. So we're taking a nice walk along the beach. He goes, so look, I read your script. What, Reservoir Dogs? No, the new one, Pulp Fiction. Wow, I mean, that blew my mind.
Yeah.
All right. And he goes, yeah, so I want to play Vincent. He goes, I want to play Vincent. I go, well, I kind of have John Travolta set up.
To play him.
For Vincent. And so he goes, well, John's great. John's terrific. John's good. So we keep talking a little bit more. And he goes, okay, well, here's the deal then. Okay, John is a good Vincent, and I wouldn't want to fuck him up, all right? So, okay. His agent later tried to throw John Travolta under the bus, all right?
It's a good agent.
He didn't, yeah, all right? Yeah. I think I even remember what his agent said. He goes, okay, Quentin, I just want to just put this out to you that when your movie comes out, the last movie Bruce will have done that will be released, and he named some big Bruce Willis movie, sure, that like grossed $300 million or something. That will be the last movie that Bruce had done when your movie comes out. The last movie the star of your movie, John Travolta, will have done will be Look Who's Talking 3. I'm just saying.
I mean, he's not a bad agent.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. That's what they do, man. Yeah.
So then all of a sudden Bruce goes, I guess, okay, well, how about this? What if I play Jules? And I go, obviously, look, I know he's black.
Face but, paint.
Sam Reams, the Sam Jackson character.
Sam Jackson. No, I know. I'm saying face paint.
Yeah. He goes, look, I know the character's black, but it's more like just, but he could just be a hipster dude, And I could do that dialogue because like that's the way me and my friends talk with each other.
Sure.
So you could make him a white guy and I could just be this hipster dude with John. And I'm telling you, that's the way Bruno talks. All right. Bruno talks like that.
Hard sell for this part, man.
Yeah. And okay. So, and that was the real hard decision.
Well, so that's real pressure at that time. I mean, for you, right? Because you have one of the top three movie stars in the world being like, I will do this.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And it's like,
fuck.
I've already said no once before to push somebody else. And now he's offering me one more bite of the apple to get his full attention and his full commitment to this movie. And the movie needs it. I mean, it's just, it's like winning the fucking lottery.
Yeah.
But it's not right. It's just not right.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him that, the part that would be fantastic for you is Butch. And
this is right in that moment. You tell him that?
Well, I let him know.
Okay.
I let him know.
Okay.
So then finally I go, okay, well, let me think. Okay. Well, that would be a big, big change. Let me think about it. And let me call you tomorrow. Okay. So I think about it all night long. And finally I realize, look, I can't do it. So I call him up and I tell him, and I'm kind of telling him how it's not going to work. And he goes, hey, Quentin, it's all okay. Let me take you off the hook. I get it. I understand. You wrote the character for a black guy. You want a black guy. I get it. I go, okay, but Bruce, yes, but I think you should be in this movie. You understand it. You get the script. You get my sense of humor. I think you should be in the movie. Now, you naturally were attracted to the Vincent character, and then you were naturally attracted to the Jules character. There is a third lead here that I think you would be perfect for. And one of the reasons I think he would be perfect for Butch is I see him as like a 50s leading man. I mean, he could be a star from a 50s movie.
Yeah.
And like the actors that I think of when I think of the character of Butch is more like actors from the 50s, like a Ralph Meeker or an Aldo Ray or a Brian Keith or somebody like that. I would ask you, you've had your mind set on other people, on other characters. I would just ask you to read the script one more time with the idea of you playing Butch. And if you don't respond, fine. But I would just ask you to read it one more time with the other characters out of your head and with that character on your plate. And then if you don't respond, you don't respond. And he goes, okay, I'll do that. I can do that. I'll do that tonight. Call me tomorrow. And so he did that. And then I called him the next day. And he said, Quentin, the shortest sentence in the Bible is Jesus wept. The shortest sentence in Hollywood is I'm in. And I'm in.
Wow. Dude, that's an awesome story.
Yeah, he was a great guy. He is a great guy.
Yeah. Wow. What an incredible get for the film.
It opened up everything. It opened up everything. And especially how successful the movie ended up being overseas.
Sure.
That is a direct result of Bruce Willis' participation.
How were you dialed in? I know you've been asked, but I don't know. How were you dialed in on Travolta for Vincent? Why? What? Like, how was that clear to you?
I was just always a big fan.
You're just always a big fan.
No, I thought it was a damn shame that he wasn't as big a star as he used to be.
Yeah.
And I thought Hollywood was full of shit, all right, for not understanding it. And it was even one of those things where it was like, at that time, John Travolta was kind of almost the epitome of you know, I guess what you would cruelly call a has-been.
Mm-hmm.
But then I would go out with him and people would lose their fucking minds. We would walk down the street and people like, you know, drive down, hey, Johnny, hey, Bubberino, they would just like scream shit at him all the time as we're walking down like La Cienega or something.
Yeah.
I took him to like a Ed DeBevick's because I go, well, this is kind of as close to Jackrabbit Slim's kind of place as it exists. So you just get an idea of what these weird places or at least what these weird 50s joints are like. And I take him in there. The whole restaurant just lost their fucking mind. Uh-huh. They actually had to put us into another section of the restaurant and keep everybody away.
Yeah.
And then even like walking outside, like some tourist family were like, ah, it was crazy. And it was just like, this guy's a superstar. It's only stupid Hollywood who doesn't realize it.
Yeah.
The public absolutely thinks he's a star. Just put him in something worth seeing and they'll go.
Wow. So you, man, that's incredible that you could see it.
Yeah.
All right, this is one where I love this these two little details in the scene, and I wonder if there was an origin for this, and that is in Inglourious Basterds. Mm-hmm. There's this character who he's supposed to be English, and he has German parents.
Yeah, yeah.
So he speaks fluent German, albeit with a subtle accent. And the reason I think that this resonates so much with me is when you have a foreign parent, your ear gets tuned to these little details about accents that people with an untrained ear don't like. Even like if you don't have a foreign, like in other words, if you're American and you speak English, you can hear somebody speak English and go like, where are you from? Like I have a friend, you know, who one of the first times we spoke and I met him, his name's Michael, and we're talking and I was like, where are you from? And he says like, you know, Washington or something. I'm like, you're from Washington? Like, your accent, so strange. He's like, well, I was born in Estonia and I came over when I was 10.
You learned to talk.
That's why you don't know that your accent's fucking weird as fuck when you talk.
Yeah.
So in the movie, what?
Yeah, I don't think Archie Hickok's accent is weird.
No,
as
no, it's
fuck.
Not. It's all not. Right. It's not.
Just not as dramatic as the Nazis.
I was making the point about my friend.
Hello, I'm Johnny Knoxville.
And I'm Elna Baker, and we have a new podcast. It's called Pretty Sure I Can Fly.
Yep, we've teamed up with my friends and barmates from Smartless to create a podcast where we talk to folks who have more balls in a bowling alley.
People who accomplished something extraordinary despite people telling them that it couldn't or shouldn't be done.
You'll hear stories about the Air Force doctor who buckled into a 600-mile-per-hour rocket sled and became the fastest man on the planet.
And a man who wrestles alligators and sharks for fun.
Do not do this.
You'll hear about a foul-mouthed moonshiner.
Got a 2-inch dick and a 6-inch tongue and knows how to use both of them.
And an even more foul-mouthed female stunt pilot. We got bull riders.
Balloonists.
Bobsledders.
And big wave surfers. People who lay their balls on an anvil and hand the other fellow the hammer.
Okay. I bet you've actually done that, Johnny.
Maybe for sweeps. Follow Pretty Sure I Can Fly on the Wondery app
or wherever you get your podcasts.
You can listen to Pretty Sure I Can Fly early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus.
Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
But what I notice as a child of a foreign parent is that you really get dialed. So like my mother speaks Spanish, right? She's from Peru. And then you grow up and you start to note some, like your ear gets tuned to people speaking Spanish.
Right.
You can start going, you start identifying countries.
Exactly. You know? It's the difference between Argentina and Peru, the difference between Mexico and Cuba, and Spain.
And then you can start to note how children of those parents, how good the child's Spanish is. In other words, in my case, the Spanish is. So you'll be like, oh, yours is really off. Yours is really good. But then your ear can pick up on just like the slightest little detail. And that theme of that scene, like that it drives it, fascinated me. I was like, oh, this is something I felt very much like I related to. And I was wondering if the origin of it or what that was for you, like why you dialed in on the fact that
this is... that's just the reality of what the case would be. But where I came up with that concept of that scene in the first place was I've seen a ton of World War II cloak and daggery kind of movies where some... we always see them where like... a couple Americans that speak German apparently speak German perfectly.
Yes.
And they put on Nazi uniforms and they go to Nazi restaurants and they go to Nazi bars and they're able to hang out at chateaus with other generals and
completely have a good time.
Completely pass themselves off, no worries. And we see that in Dirty Dozen with Lee Marvin and Charles Bronson dressed up as officers go to that chateau where all the other generals are hanging out. And it's also really played up big in Where Eagles Dare. Because remember, like Clint Eastwood and Richard Burton are all dressed up as Nazi officers, and they're just kicking it in German and selling everything. Now, naturally, them being American movies, nobody's speaking German. All right, they're all speaking English, and we're supposed to just know they're speaking German. And so, what should be the most greatest element of suspense, can they pull off the German inside of a room full of motherfucking Nazis?
It's so great.
I mean, doesn't exist at all in these movies because English is German, and of course they can speak English, and naturally there's never an issue about their accent. But then to do it not with a German actor, but with a guy doing German, and then pulling it off or not pulling it off. Now, that's a whole element of suspense that I've never seen played out in a movie before.
Absolutely.
Even though I've seen that scene like seemingly 100 times.
Sure. I love that because I think it's such an original take. And it also like, you get it there. The other, by the way, this is not related to it, but this is related to accents and in your films in Kill Bill, when you have Michael Parks playing Esteban. I did not know that that wasn't a Mexican guy. I mean, he
was terrific.
But like, I appreciate it so much as an audience member. Watching this guy speak, and you're like, oh, I wonder what Mexican guy this is. Actor. He's like, so. And then you realize.
Then came Bronson.
Man, it's crazy because. Yeah. It also takes me out of other movies when you have somebody half-assing the accent.
Right on.
You know, and I'm like, yo, man, like this is terrible. Like it ruins the scene. It ruins the whole dialogue. I mean, I was watching, what was it, House of Gucci? They were like, they're like doing.
Mamma mia. Yeah. Well, I haven't seen it, so I'm not making fun of that movie. But
it's dog shit. But he, But like the actors are like, I mean, they're all big actors, but they're going like, I want these to work out. I'm dad. Are you sick? And like, it's in the same scene. You're just like, yo, man, you just dropped the accent.
Oh, they did.
Yeah. You're just, it's like the whole accent just dropped. I don't know. Parks was unbelievable in that part.
Well, that's actually an interesting story about how that came about. Cause you know, Michael Parks is actually one of my favorite actors and I already cast him in the movie. He was, plays the Texas Ranger.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, so we always have a big, a big day in our movies is when I have the script reading. We all get together. The actors have been cast. We're getting ready to start production maybe in a couple of weeks. And then we get together with the actors and we just all sit around a table and read the script.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very, very important day for me because that's like the closest to me actually seeing the movie finished before I start shooting the movie because you get it. The first time I've heard the script with the actors that are going to play the roles all kind of doing the thing, I get a sense of the movie. And so the thing is, you have a bunch of actors and maybe not everybody is there, so like, oh hey, you take this role, hey you read this one.
Mm-hmm.
And I had actually had cast Ricardo Montalban
to play Esteban.
And he couldn't make it. So Michael was there because he was playing the Texas Ranger. So mm-hmm. he did the Texas Ranger role. And then I threw something else at him and threw something else at him. And then I go, hey, Mike, would you play Esteban? He goes, yeah, sure. And he did such a fantastic Esteban.
At this table read.
Yeah, at this table read. It was... just stole the show. It was just great. And there also is this aspect, as wonderful as an actor as Michael Parks is, he was always cast inside of his own persona
mm-hmm.
to one degree. Now, you can take your own persona a zillion different ways, but he was never cast to be somebody completely different.
Sure.
I mean, like a complete other type of humanity
mm-hmm.
than who he was and talk in a completely different way than the way he talked. But here he was doing it. And I always knew he was a fantastic actor, this could be fantastic. He's never been given an opportunity to do a character like this.
Yeah.
So we paid off Ricardo Montalban and I cast Michael instead.
God, that's got to suck to get that call. That's got to suck so bad.
Well, his ass should have been at the fucking table.
Yeah,
right,
he should have been. Yeah.
You know, if he had someplace better to be, then we have someplace better to be too.
And it's with Michael Parks, motherfucker.
Yeah, Michael Parks. Yeah. Michael Parks wasn't too busy.
Jesus.
There you go.
I worked on a movie where I think it was like, was it the hair guy? I mean, I love hair, but I was in the hair chair or something.
Uh-huh.
And he had been on all your films at that point. And so I was like, oh, what's it like to work on Quentin mm-hmm. films? He goes, he loves to shoot, man. Mm-hmm. He loves to shoot. He said you guys were down, I think, shooting that for months longer.
Which one?
I think the Kill Bill, whatever you filmed in Mexico.
Okay.
Yeah. But you don't really love to shoot, but you love to shoot. You shoot film. You still do,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Uh-huh, yeah. Uh-huh.
And does anybody else do that?
Yeah. Christopher Nolan does, you know.
But it's just a handful, right?
Yeah. It is a handful. Yeah.
Sounds like a handful of the highest level.
Yes, actors. Exactly. It's a handful of the best.
Of the best. So the best guys shoot on film.
Yeah.
That scene also, by the way, the other coolest fuck thing about the pastor scene is the three fingers.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
It's such a cool little detail. Mm-hmm. Did it just come about? Something you knew? You'd seen
before? I'd heard about it. All right. And go, hey, well, that's terrific. And it was actually really funny because one of my makeup gals is... she's from Iceland, Heba.
Mm-hmm.
And she's been working with me for God, almost 20 years now. Anyway, so she's reading the script. She got sent the script and she's reading it. And she reads the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, you know, so, well, she's from Iceland. So yeah, they do it like this. Mm-hmm. All right. And she's like, what the fuck is he talking about? And I don't get that. You know, so she goes to her husband, who's American. She goes, hold up three fingers. And he goes like this. Fuck, he's right.
Yeah. It's so distinct.
Yeah, yeah.
And something you never really think about.
Yeah, it's something you never think about.
Until exactly. somebody points it out. It's such a cool thing. When you, what's the Top Gun is gay?
Yeah, from a Sleep With Me, yeah.
Yeah, you wrote that.
Yeah, well, me and my buddy Roger Avery kind of, I think Roger came up, Roger did, I don't think. Roger did come up with it first. Mm-hmm. But back when we were at Video Archives, we worked on it. We turned it into a routine.
That
we did at parties. Okay. We did it at parties. We did it at gatherings. It was just this routine that the two of us did together.
It feels like stand-up. Like,
yeah. It was a whole routine that we did together. And then I was doing a cameo in this fun little movie that I was doing, and I was just told to pretty much improvise something.
Okay.
Well, I had that routine ready to go.
You nailed it, dude.
And so I just did it, and that became a thing.
Dude, it's so good. I mean, it reminded me in a way of Reservoir Dogs when you go on about Like a Virgin.
Yeah.
It's in the same vein.
Yeah.
In the same vein, and it feels like, you know, as like a stand up, you go like, oh, this feels like a routine, a good bit.
That would definitely be part of my 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Building up that good 5 minutes.
Dude, you'd crush with that. You'd crush. I know this is probably, I don't know if this is tired topic to you, but you know, like it, there's so much made about race when you every time if I go pitch now, mm-hmm. do you know, they're like, who's this character? And you're like, that's the friend. They're like, are they Indian or something? And mm-hmm. you're like, I mean, I don't know. Sure. Should they be? Mm-hmm. And they're like, it would be better. And you're like, okay. And it feels like it's so forced.
Into
these conversations that
But that's not even new. I mean, there is the thing about what was it? I think You Got Mail. I think it's You Got Mail. All right.
That's the Tom Hanks.
Yeah, Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan movie. Yeah. And he's the vice president of Barnes and Noble or something like that. But his best friend is Dave Chappelle.
Yeah.
Where's the world where the vice president of Barnes and Noble's best friend is Dave Chappelle?
Yeah. It's almost like back to that studio guy being like, well, I feel better.
Yeah, no, it is. Well, it's exactly what that is.
Yeah.
Okay. For different reasons.
Right.
But it's this, yeah.
But it still is a thing today where even when you, like I said, every time I've gone in to pitch something, mm-hmm. they're like, well, like, so this person's Latin and this is Asian and they're like, great. Now we're good to go. And you're like,
oh, yeah.
Like,
well, I don't have to play that bullshit.
No, you don't have to do any of that shit. You feel like any of...
But, I mean, I have a, you know, I'm actually quite known for writing my black characters, all right? But I'm not going to, you know, but it's like, well, no, if I wanted him to be black, I would have made him black. If I wanted him to be Mexican, I would have made the character Mexican.
Did you get pushback back then, though, about... No.
No.
You already obviously a huge success with Django, but was mm-hmm. that, were they like, this is too much? This is too crazy?
No, the studios were lined up. They all wanted to do
it.
They were fighting for it.
Fighting for it.
Yeah.
It wasn't too.
No, it was, they were fighting. They were fighting to get it.
Wow. That's pretty rad. Mm-hmm. One thing I wanted to ask you too is that, so I'm, my favorite genre of films to watch, like if we walk to the theater and mm-hmm. you're like, there's 10 movies out, I'm always drawn towards thrillers.
Yeah.
That's just what I enjoy the most.
Yeah, they're fun. This is like my wife too.
Yeah.
She doesn't like horror movies, but she loves thrillers.
I love thrillers. Mm-hmm. What is like a Quentin recommended, you know, couple thrillers? Because I'm imagining I definitely have not seen everything you've seen. That you would...
Well, if you're going to try and have me pick something completely off the beaten track. Okay, I got one.
Okay.
All right. I mean, when you say that to me, a thriller, like the first things that come to my mind are something like Dressed to Kill or Fatal Attraction or mm-hmm. something like that. But a cool one that's off the that you might not have seen that's really good and it actually stars an actor I don't like at all, but he's actually pretty good in this movie.
yes.
Is a film directed by Curtis Hanson, who later did L.A. Confidential.
Uh-huh.
Called The Bedroom Window.
The Bedroom Window.
Yeah, it was like in the late 80s. It was done. It was done for Dino De Laurentiis' company, DEG, the same company that did Blue Velvet and Raw Deal and things like that. And it's a kind of a Hitchcockian Rear Window kind of redo. And it's with Steve Guttenberg and Elizabeth McGovern, who's fantastic in the movie. She steals the movie. But also Isabelle Huppert, who's wonderful in it, too. Wally Shawn has a magnificent cameo in it that just brings the house down. It's a really, really fun thriller.
Okay.
It's very Hitchcockian. It's meant to be like a Hitchcock homage.
Were you a big Hitchcock guy?
Not a Hitchcock fan.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Tell me, because I would imagine, I think you talk to most people who go like cinema is everything, that he's like, you know,
he's one of the greatest directors who ever lived. Yeah. I think he was held back by the times that he worked. I think his movies, I normally don't like the third acts of his movies. Now, some of them I do. Well, Strangers on a Train has a magnificent third act.
The third act of thrillers is the, like, well, all, but like, especially thrillers.
Yeah. But I do think that they oftentimes, this is just my opinion. They oftentimes peter out, and he's not quite able to end them like, you know, the way I think he would have if he was coming. If he was the age he was in the 50s, in the 70s, I think I would appreciate his films more. I think he's held back by the Hays Code. I think he was really, truly held back by the Hays Code. Now, at the same time, he was a clever little bugger. All right. So because he could use the Hays Code against their own selves from time to time. One of my actually favorite Hitchcock endings seems to be a compromise forced on him. But then he subverts the compromise. There's an expression in Hebrew called fuk lefuk, which means like a reverse on a reverse. And he kind of does a fuk lefuk at the end of the movie Suspicion. If you've ever seen Suspicion, it's with Cary Grant and Joan Fontaine. And the whole idea is Joan Fontaine is thinking she's married this cad played by Cary Grant. And little by little, she starts thinking that maybe he's trying to kill her.
Mm-hmm.
And little by little, we're thinking, oh, he's trying to fucking kill her.
Uh-huh.
And so it's going on, it's going on, it's going on, it's going on. And well, naturally in the original script, yes, of course he was trying to fucking kill her. But then the Hays goes, no, we can't do that. You can't have Cary Grant actually be a killer.
Uh-huh.
So at the end, it has to be explained that she was wrong. No, he wasn't trying to do it. It looks suspicious, but no, it's just, she's wrong. She's wrong. He wasn't trying to kill her at all. So that plays out. And like, it looks like, you know, he's taking her to the cliffs of Dover to throw her off. And then she confronts him, you're trying to kill me, or whatever. Mm-hmm. He goes, what are you talking about? I'm not trying to kill you. But you did this. Well, here's the reason why I did this, you know.
It's plausible.
Yeah, well, no. More, I don't buy it.
Yeah.
It seems like dick sucking as far as I'm concerned. You know, they're trying to talk themselves out of the corner that they painted themselves in. I find it completely unconvincing.
Mm-hmm.
All right. But she doesn't. And the movie seems to wrap up. And then they get in the car and they drive home. So apparently everything's fine. And Hitchcock ends it with this shot. Like they're driving a roadster, a convertible roadster. Hitchcock ends it with this shot behind them. And he's driving and she's in the passenger seat. And like everything seems okay. And in this really creepy way, Cary Grant puts his arm around her. Oh, shit! He is going to kill her.
Yeah.
He's just talked his way out of it.
Oh, nice.
All right. He's just talked his way. But once he gets her home, he's going to fucking kill her. Now, they don't say that.
Right, right.
But it's kind of implied by the creepiness of the last shot.
I'm going to watch this tonight.
Oh, yeah. It's a good movie. It's really good.
Suspicion?
Oh,
man. I'd love to do that to somebody.
And he's fantastic. And Cary Grant made a great villain. He should have played villains more. He's a magnificent villain.
Yeah, they did so many films together.
Yeah.
I feel like he did like a dozen.
Yeah, he did a lot of them, yeah.
So a lot has been made about, I know you're gonna continue writing, right? You enjoy writing now.
Yeah.
But you're still-
I always enjoyed writing.
Well, you always enjoyed writing, but I'm saying you're going to write more books. But you are going to do one more film?
Yeah, I've got one more, yeah.
Written yet or no?
No, I haven't even thought about it yet.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Man,
I just finished a book.
I know. I know. But that's so exciting that you're going to do one more.
Yeah, I think it'll be fun.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So you'll just take your gem, like just a little idea seed and just sit down with your pad, get to it. How long does a movie take to pour out of you normally?
Oh, I don't know. Well, I just have to come up with, one, I have to be ready to make another movie.
Yeah.
You know, and then I have to have a neat idea. And then, and I'm not in any hurry to make my last movie, to tell you the truth.
Sure.
So, so whenever that idea comes up, you know, I'll probably start writing it. Like I said, I'm in no hurry in that regard, especially right now, because I don't even know what I'd be writing it for. I don't even, you know, do movies the way I have always known them, do they even exist right now? I think that remains to be seen.
Sure.
And so I kind of would like to know what I'm writing it for, what's going on, what is the deal?
There's this theme that has occurred in a few of your last few films, mm-hmm. which is kind of a fantasy revenge endings,
uh-huh,
right?
Uh-huh.
Because Inglourious Bastards has it.
Uh-huh.
Django has this like revenge.
Yeah. Well, revisionist history.
Revisionist, sure, guy, sure. Yeah. And then Once Upon a Time.
Yeah, three of them have it. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
That's sort of my revenge. That's sort of my.
Your revenge trilogy?
Well, not my revenge trilogy, my revisionist history trilogy.
Okay. But like do you feel like that's something that you would be drawn to still? Or
well,
not?
Since I don't know what I'm going to do for the next one, I don't have an answer for that. But I don't think I would do that for the last one. I think, like I said, I think. I had no problem doing it with the Manson one because I was just like, that's my revisionist history trilogy.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, that's that.
And you picked, is 10 for you like a special, like, you know, some people have these numbers that they're like, this would be your 10th film.
Yeah.
Is it 10 for, or just you just feel like one more is all you want to do?
Well, I think 10's a good number.
Okay. So
yeah,
it is.
I think 10, yeah. Also, I'm at that point where I think, okay, it's ready to. Bow off the stage, leave them wanting more.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Don't make any left-handed movies. Don't make any movies for the wrong reason. Don't muddy up my filmography with a bunch of out of touch old man movies.
Is that hard to do though?
What?
Is that hard to do to say that, like, you know what I mean? To go like, I mean, I imagine as a filmmaker, a lot of them you go, I'm just going to keep making movies forever, you know? Like,
well, I think that's what most of them want to do.
Yeah. Right. But is it hard?
What, to make movies forever?
To have the perspective of like one more and then it's a great catalog and I walk away. Is it hard to leave it?
No, I don't think so. I mean, because I've done everything I wanted to do.
Okay.
I've done everything I wanted to do. I mean, I've had just an amazing career. I've had an amazing amount of luck, amazing good fortune. I had no idea that the audience would, in fact, if I had to guess, I would guess that the audience wouldn't have accepted my movies.
Really?
And that ended up not being the case. And I've been able to work at in this business at the highest level. At the highest level a director can work. And I want to leave at that high level.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I want to leave where a new Quentin Tarantino movie coming out is an event.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who like my stuff and who follow my stuff and even that, like, no, they want to see it and they want to see it opening night.
Right.
And I don't want to just be that. I'll go, oh, yeah, I remember when I was so into him.
Yeah.
I remember when I was so passionate. I remember when I had that shit on my wall.
Right.
You know, I remember all that stuff.
25 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and I mean, you know, not. I mean, look, he's fun and everything, you know, but he's an old man and it's not the same thing.
Yeah.
And he's out of touch and he has no idea who the new filmmakers are. He has no idea the new movies are out. Now he's just doing his own thing.
Would you continue to produce and stuff, though, or?
I don't like producing. I'm not if I'm not making a movie, I don't want to fucking make a movie.
Okay. All right. I didn't know.
Making movies are hard work. If I'm not making it for me, I'm not interested.
So it would really be back to like writing.
Look, I could do a TV show or something like that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I could do a TV show. That would be different. You know, I could do that.
Get ready to back up a Brinks truck for Quentin, man. I mean, these checks are big these fucking days, dude. Holy shit. You just put the feel. Your agents are jerking off right now in the other room. They're like, he does?
Yeah. Well, I'll say one thing. Okay, I'll let something out of the bag right now. I won't say anything about what it is or whatever, but I have written a TV show. I've written 8 episodes. all right, of a limited series. I've written all 8 episodes. I direct all 8 episodes. I need to do a polish on it. But, you know, that might be what I, like, start setting up next year.
Dude, can I read, please? Can I just get can I read for you?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Okay. Hey, it's on camera.
yeah, sure.
And you signed a contract. You don't realize what you signed when you walked in.
Yeah, right.
Dude, you have a fucking 8-episode limited series?
Yeah.
That's so exciting. And it has not, you have not sent it
no,
out?
No. My agents read it, and like a couple people I'll be working on as producers. They're the only ones I've read it.
This is breaking news.
Yeah, it is breaking news.
Holy shit. Guys, put this shit out right now. Fuck, man. I know this is like a thing that when people get so successful that you must be asked it, but do you ever stop and go like, holy shit? Like your name is a reference.
Yeah.
You know, if like somebody picks up a camera and goes, I'm going to go shoot this. I'm like, okay, Tarantino.
Yeah.
Like, right? Like you're a reference.
Yeah.
Is it wild to you?
It's awesome. It's amazing. Look, it's what I always wanted. I mean, not that I always thought I would get it. If I was able to get work at all, that was the question.
Right.
And that was a question I didn't know the answer to. But if things were to work out, I thought I would have some level of this success. But to actually have the level of success I had and be able to hold on to it.
Yeah.
For 30 years where, you know, I came up with a lot of different people, but they all kind of have, not all of them, but a lot of them have kind of fallen by the wayside. Not all of them. Rick Linkletter is still up there working, doing good. But a lot of other people have, I thought we would all be working together, into our old age. But that's just not really how it works.
No.
In town.
Well, that's the thing that I think the longer that you do anything in entertainment, the more you appreciate more than anything is the longevity of somebody's career. Like when you go, you've been doing this for 30 years. It's crazy.
Yeah, exactly.
It's, at a high level.
And that's the key. You just, as far as I'm concerned, you just said the key right there is to be able to work at this level.
Yeah.
I'm not working at a lower level. I'm not working at if I want to do a $4 million movie, that's my choice.
Right.
I'm not reduced to doing $4 million movies.
Yeah. Yeah. By the way, I thought about you. You inspired me to do something. You were a big part of the inspiration, which was, I've heard you say, just go out and make something.
Yeah, right on.
And so me and my friend, Rami Hashash, we got together and spent my own money. We shot a proof of concept for a show.
Oh, wow, good deal. Good for you.
So I remember you saying this stuff because like you can just do that.
Yeah.
You can just do that now.
Just go for it. Yeah. And now you can do it. Before you had to, we got to get a cinematographer. We got to get a camera.
It cost me way more money than I ever thought I would spend in my life.
But
we still did it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Cause they lied to me about how much it would cost.
Yeah. No, but then now you're committed.
Yeah.
Now you're there. You're committed. Okay. Yeah. What the fuck? It's like building a house.
Yeah. Well, I could have bought a house.
Yeah. It's like building a house. Okay. It's going to cost more and it's going to take way fucking longer than they ever say.
Yeah. Fucking
what? It's like the money pit.
Yeah. It's exactly what it is. And then I get calls about, well, now we got to get more for this. And I was like, I thought that was the budget, bro.
Yeah.
I thought the budget was the budget. Yeah. And they're like, nah, you got to write another check. But thank you for helping me spend all that money.
Yeah. You're welcome.
Yeah. I thought of you so much in that.
I remember I could give you a hole in your backyard to throw money into.
Oh, dude. It's so much fun. Like, people, I mean, it's amazing now with technology that you really can go shoot something for not a lot of money. Mm-hmm. But if you want to spend the money, you can.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, if you look in the right places, you can spend the money.
I remember... we were working with a car guy, and we had a car and we wanted to change something in it.
Yeah.
That would, to make it operate differently. I think we were trying to like can we take this car and for our purposes in the movie, can we take the, it's a stick shift. Can we make it an automatic? Is that possible? And then the car guy goes, yeah, we can do that. how would you do that exactly? Well, you open up the hood and then you take a bunch of money and you stuff it inside.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then it works.
And then it works. And now you got your automatic.
Yeah. Fucking cool, man. Thanks. How much? All the money. That's the answer.
I think a lot of money.
All the money is what it takes. Are you a fan at all? Because I don't know what it's like on set with you, but do you give people, or do you ever do improv takes with your actors? Or is it like
from time to time?
Yeah. Cause I heard, and I've not heard the story firsthand, heard it secondhand, that Leo losing his shit in his trailer.
What happened there was I knew I wanted to have that scene, but I didn't want to write it out. I didn't want it to have to be dialogue he remembered. Mm-hmm. So I got Leo and I was like saying, so look, here's what I want to do. I want you to come in having fucked up on set, not knowing your lines. And I want you to come in the trailer and have a whole mad anger at yourself, detest fest, a complete tinder tantrum against yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And a whole detest fest on you, and just just a gigantic pity party where you just lose your shit.
Yeah.
But against yourself, nobody else, just you. And nobody else sees it, just you. And I want you to, and I want it to have the randomness of an improv. It just comes out of you. Now, what I did do though, is I gave him different subjects he could rant about,
mm-hmm.
different things. So, okay, well, here's a subject. Here's something you could say.
Which helps. This helps.
Yeah, here's something else you could say. Here's something you could say. And so I gave him some subjects. I gave him some bullet points and even a couple of pieces of lines, all right, that he could go on. And and he goes, great. Okay. And he was a little nervous. He was nervous. It was actually very cute that he was really, he was nervous that day. Because
uh-huh.
It's on him. And he knows that. And so we're shooting in this scene and I'm like right by the camera as we're shooting. And so he's doing it and we just do a few different takes and it was great. And then from time to time, if I thought he ran out of something, I could throw something his way. Okay. Talk about that little girl. Yeah, that fucking little girl looking at me like that. Yeah. She's judging me. Who the fuck is she to judge me, man? Fuck that little girl. Yeah. You know? Yeah. And then Jim says, yeah, fuck that fucking Jim Stacy just sitting there looking at me, laughing at me. Fuck that dude.
That's fun. It's fun to get to be able to riff with suggestions.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So you were able to give suggestions. Do you feel like, by the way, that there's, I don't know, there's less movie star, like name sells tickets now.
No, well, that's definitely the case.
So, because there's like five real movie stars.
Yeah, that's definitely the case.
And you put like three of them, like they'll all do your movies.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, that's, no, I mean, that is one of the, and I'm not even putting them down, frankly, to tell you the truth, but that is one of the legacy of the marvelization of Hollywood movies.
Yeah.
Where it's
you love these movies, these Marvel movies.
I don't love them. No, I don't love
I know.
Them. All right. I don't hate them. All right. But I don't love them. All right. I mean, look, I used to collect Marvel comics like crazy when I was a kid. And so there's an aspect that if these movies were coming out when I was in my 20s, I would totally be fucking happy and totally love them. I mean, they wouldn't be the only movies being made. They would be those movies amongst other movies. I'm almost 60. So yeah, no, I'm not quite as excited about them as.
Can I tell you the thing? I mean, for me, I don't have your level of knowledge of mm-hmm. cinema, but mm-hmm. as a film goer, somebody who likes movies, I mean, what's exciting about a movie mm-hmm. is usually some element of surprise, right?
Uh-huh.
And what you see, what I've seen in a lot of these films is that it is just a carbon copy essentially of the previous release. Like you're never taken somewhere you don't expect in the film.
Yeah, well, look, I'm not here to rag on those. Yeah, you know, so it's like, you know, I don't have any, my only axe to grind against them is they're the only things that seem to be made.
Making,
and they're the only things that seem to generate any kind of excitement.
right,
amongst a fan base, or just, or even like for the studio making them.
Mm-hmm.
All right. That's what they're excited about.
True.
And, you know, so it's just the fact that they are the entire representation of this era of movies right now.
Right.
And there's not really much room for anything else. Yeah. That's my problem.
And they do like billion-dollar box offices.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah, but that is literally my problem. It's a problem of representation.
Okay.
But to go back to your initial question, part of the Marvelization of Hollywood is, yeah, no, it's the, you have all these actors who have become famous playing these
parts,
characters,
yeah, yeah.
But they're not movie stars.
Right.
Captain America is the star.
Right.
Thor is the star. I mean, I'm not the first person to say that. I think that's been said a zillion times. But it's like, you know, it's these franchise characters that become a star.
Personally, I mean, this is my own thing, is just that I've gone to these movies and mm-hmm. you just go like, yeah, it's not that different from the previous film. Yeah. There's some new effects.
Here's a better way to say it. It's like, you know, before, even 2005, 2009 or something like that, if an actor stars in a movie that does as good as the Marvel movies do, well, that guy's a new star.
Sure.
They're an absolute star. And that means that people dig him or her.
Yeah.
And they like them and they want to see them and stuff. And then they, you know, Sandra Bullock is in Speed.
Right.
All right. And everyone like thought she was amazing in it. All right. She was charming as hell. Everyone fell in love with her. And so, you know, even she does a couple of mediocre movies after that, The Net and something else. Okay. Well, people went to see it because they were like excited Sandra by Bullock. Sandra Bullock. They want to see her in something else. And she's good in those movies.
Yeah.
You know, but that's not the case now.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not the case.
No. We want to see that guy playing whoever, Wolverine or whatever.
Yeah. Oh, fuck. Another one. Was there anything in the last few years, movie-wise, that you're like, I've really enjoyed this film?
I've seen a few things, but I didn't really want to talk about new stuff.
Okay, all right. Well, just because we're doing this book?
No, because I just don't like to talk about new stuff.
Really?
Yeah.
Why the aversion?
Well, because I don't want to say anything bad about anybody's movie, because that's me like attacking them, almost like an ambush. And I'm not here to cheerlead for anybody else's shit either.
Hey, fuck you. I had no idea. Okay, fuck your movies. All right, we'll do Quentin movies only. Yeah, fuck them.
No, but that's part of the thing, though, is like, you know, directors can't talk about anybody else's stuff. That's unfair. And so everything is about cheerleading. I'm fucking tired of cheerleading.
No, hey, man. There was
even on my podcast, okay, we're not choosing me and Roger on the Video Archives podcast. We're not choosing movies that we love. We're choosing, I'm trying to put movies, we watch three movies and I try to have at least one of them, one movie I haven't seen, so I can watch a movie and we'll see how I feel about it.
And you'll give an honest take on those.
Oh, absolutely. But we're not watching new shit. We're watching stuff on VHS.
Right. So most of those guys are not working.
Yeah, who cares?
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, you know, that's like this, all right? You know, like, you know, these movies are all over 40 years old, all right? You know, I can say whatever the fuck I want about them.
Sure.
The directors are big boys. They got it.
Now, this reminded me of, George Carlin, mm-hmm. he would bring this, he's been dead a while. Mm-hmm. He would bring this regular opener and mm-hmm. people were like, they were like, that guy's not that great. And he was like, yeah, it's not his fucking show.
Yeah.
I don't care what you think of him. I thought that was great. I mean, most guys are like, oh, you know, I brought this guy. I want you to. And he was like, yeah, that guy's just filling time.
Yeah, right.
You're here to see me.
Yeah, right. Oh, that's funny. Oh, yeah, so he's not actually going out and handpicking, you know, the best dude, all right, from the club that he saw in Cleveland.
He's
all
like,
right.
This guy's just while people's seat. He'll be up there. Go ahead and get a drink. When he's done, the real show starts.
Yeah, okay.
So he wasn't advocating for some, you need to check this guy out. He's so funny. He was like, fuck.
Well, I remember the person who would talk about that is when he'd watch, he'd go see Don Rickles.
Oh,
because when Don Rickles would do his show, he would never have a comedian open his show. He would always have like some singer that you've never heard of. Some woman usually go out and sing a bunch of songs. And then he'd come out and rag on her. You know, but I mean, you expect Don Rickles to rag on you. All right. He goes, okay, then she came out there. Apparently she thought she was doing a live album.
Rickles would, you know, he would lay into everybody.
Yeah, yeah.
So you get, I mean, some of
the he laid into me a couple times.
Oh, did he?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Good ones?
Oh, they were hysterical.
Yeah, he was so fucking funny. And he was with the Dodgers one time, and this fucking Dominican baseball player, he comes up. He's like, how's it going? How's the language treating you? Your wife still cleaning hotel rooms? Yeah. And he like sends him on his way. But I had, I know somebody who went to see him live, and they were so excited, and they wanted to get lit up.
All right, yeah.
So they put on like goofy glasses.
Oh yeah, so he would point it in the eye.
And like, you know, buttoned up all the way. Mm-hmm. And they kind of looked like, you know, almost like special needs.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were like, and he came by and put his hand on them and said, it's going to be all right. They went too far. They went too far. So he saw.
I heard like Bill Burr. All right, was saying something about like he went and saw Don Rickles and he's excited and like he kind of wants to get a little bit. And Donny Boy. Yeah, I know my name. And it's like yes, I got one. Dude,
it would be so amazing to get. I mean, you got it. You got lit up by him.
Yeah, yeah.
In person.
Yeah. Uh huh.
At a show or no?
No. I just at a party. Just at an Oscar thing. And it was during the time where I was having a bit of doing more acting and everything. And then he was like he goes, yeah, this kid comes out as a director. And now he's like, oh, no, I don't do that anymore. No, I'm going to star in movies. But not only that, the best one, though, was this was talk about embarrassing. Literally wanted to hide under the carpet. I was in, speaking of acting, I was like in Vegas. I was acting in a movie in Vegas. And it just turned out that during that time, Scorsese was doing Casino in Vegas at the time. And I think Paul Verhoeven was doing Showgirls in Vegas. That they were both simultaneously taking over Vegas doing these movies. And so I had a day off, and I'd never really met Martin Scorsese before, and so I got an invite to go visit the set of Casino. So I'm going to meet Scorsese. I'd met De Niro before, but I'd never met Scorsese, and now I'm going to actually go on Scorsese's set, and he knows I'm coming. So the whole idea is I'm going to come for like an hour before lunch, or maybe 2 hours before lunch, and just kind of watch him shoot and all that, and then we would have lunch together.
Super excited.
Yeah, it's fucking me. That was great. And so they're shooting in some showgirl area. You know, a bunch of showgirls in De Niro. And so Don Rickles is in that movie, and he was on set that day. So I'm walking. I've just done Pulp Fiction. I've only done two movies. I'm meeting one of my heroes for the very first time. I'm walking on Scorsese. I'm going to have lunch with him later. This is right up there with, you know, the Gates of Oz opening up, and I'm going to meet the wizard.
Yeah.
So I'm walking to meet the wizard. I'm walking on the set. They kind of see me. And then Don Rickles goes, Quentin, thank God you're here. This guy doesn't know what he's doing at all. Thank God a real director has finally showed up. This cat is out of it. Please say this is a disaster. It's a disaster. Please save us from this wreckage. You are a talented man. We need your talent.
Oh my God.
Okay, now Marty's laughing. The crew is laughing. Yeah. De Niro's laughing. I want to hide under the carpet.
Yeah, of course. So funny.
Cold sweat.
So funny though, dude. That is so, I've told this before. So when I worked with Norm McDonald and I was asking him about the Rickles scene in Dirty Work. And he's like, we couldn't even get, we only had him for like a few hours and they couldn't get through the scene because Rickles was just making them laugh. and they're supposed to stay straight. Just like, he's just busting their charts.
Firing him.
And they're like, we're at the end of the window that we have them. We still don't have it. Literally, people keep doubling over. And they finally get it. And then it's like 2 weeks later, he's coming back for another piece they're shooting. And it's the week that Sinatra is dying in the hospital.
Okay.
So Norm's like, it's in the news. So he's like, hey, I just want to say, I'm sorry about Frank. And Don goes, oh, yeah. I was with him yesterday in the hospital, and he was all, he was like, oh, my God. So even then, he's still ripping on his dying friend, he just didn't fucking
care. You know that great Pat Henry joke about Frank Sinatra? He goes, yeah, Frank Sinatra saved my life once. These two mafia goons were beating the fuck out of me in an alley. And the Sinatra goes, okay, boys, he's had enough.
that's good, too. Did you, because I didn't get asked, you mentioned him. Was it I'm assuming a dream to book or to get De Niro for Jackie Brown?
No, it was wonderful. Yeah, no, it was a big deal. That was also kind of a funny story, too, as far as it kind of matches almost the Bruce Willis story, where I wrote Jackie Brown, and I decided at some point in writing the script that Robert Forster would be terrific as Max Cherry.
Don't forget I have a Robert Forster story. Okay, cool. Go ahead.
And so while I'm still writing the script, I bump into Robert Forster. We go into a coffee shop that was similar, that we went to a bunch.
The Silver?
Yeah, Silver Spoons. Yeah.
That's where my story takes place.
And so I decide I'm going to give him the part, because I figure, look, if I don't get this would be a big, big deal part. So if I don't give him the part, then once I'm done with it and it gets out in the town, then it's going to be like Gene Hackman's and Paul Newman's and people like that will be pretty hard to say no to.
Right.
But if I just give him the part right now, I've got the juice to get it through, and now I can't take it back because I wouldn't be a man of my word.
Yeah.
So to lock myself into that decision, I give it to him before I finish writing it. And so then now comes the time to do it. And so Robert De Niro reads it, and he wants to be in it, but he wants to play Max. Mm-hmm. And they go, well, look, you would be a fantastic Max, but I've already given that to Robert Forster, and I'm a man of my word. I can't take it back. Now, De Niro is very much a man of his word, so he understands that.
Mm-hmm.
He gets that. And he's just like, it's just disappointing. It's regretful. I go, what? Well, just because, you were thinking about him, so you wrote it for him. But if we had had more dinners and hung out a little bit more, then you would have been thinking about me, and you would have written it for me. And I understand what happened, but that could have been changed if we had spent more time with each other before this. So he kind of gives me the same Bruce Willis thing. Well, think about it.
Yeah.
Just think about it for a couple of days. All right. And then, kind of a going, gone situation. Think about it for a couple of days and then let's talk again. Maybe Bob could play Lewis, the other guy.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I actually have Bob read Lewis, all right, with me, and then read Max. And if that could work, maybe that could work. But it wasn't. No, everything that made him perfect for Max made him wrong for Lewis. And so I get on the phone with De Niro. No, I was in person, actually, with De Niro. And I go, I explored that, but no, everything about him that makes him perfect for Max makes him wrong to play this ex-convict guy. And he goes, yeah, I get that. Okay, so tell me about this Lewis character. I go, you would consider playing Lewis? Yeah, it's a good character. It's a good movie. I want to be part of it. It's a good character. I wanted the other character, but yeah, this is a good character. I'd be happy to play it. I go, well, you didn't let me know that before. I go, well, I didn't want to let you off the hook. I wanted Lewis. I wanted you. You were on the hook. I wanted you on the hook.
Yeah.
But now, if that ship has sailed, then let's talk about Lewis.
Well, and then it
and was then that worked out. Yeah,
done deal. I recognized Robert Forster, and it was a cool thing to recognize him because it made me feel like I was recognizing somebody kind of under the radar.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. It's one thing when you're in LA where you see fucking Matt Damon or something. You're like, well, yeah, that's Matt Damon.
But it's like Robert Forster. You see Don Stroud.
Yeah. So I'm going to that diner and I see him there and I, you know, He was always there. He was there every day. Yeah.
If he wasn't on location, he was there.
I would see him reading a paper.
Yeah.
And I just like, oh, that's Robert Forster. Yeah. And then one day I'm driving by there and he's stalled in the street.
Oh, holy shit.
And it's Super Bowl Sunday. And so I reckon I start to go by and I go, do you need a jump? Mm-hmm. And he's like, yes. Mm-hmm. And so I get out and he's very nice and very thankful.
Yeah.
And he's like, so what do you do, young man? You know, and I go, I'm a comedian.
Yeah, we're at the comedy store.
Yeah, I'm a comic. And he's like, are you on HBO? And I go, no, I'm fucking 22, man. Yeah. And he was like,
someday, yeah. Hopefully.
I was like, I hope so. Right, he's like, where can I see like your stuff? And I was like, I mean, up there at the club.
Potluck Thursday.
Yeah. I have bringer shows where I could pay somebody for you to they'll let me do stand up if I pay them.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, okay. He's like, so, and he brought up HBO a second time. He's like, so not HBO. I go, no, man, not fucking HBO. And then I jumped his car and that was it. Yeah. That was it. Yeah. I know you got to run, but, it's a real treat. Thank you for coming and congrats on the book.
Ooh, okay. You said you've been reading it for a little bit. All right. Where are you up to now?
I don't know. You are talking about going to, you've started to go to
opening the chapter.
Yeah. But I didn't read it. I told you that.
I know. Boy, you were still listening to it.
I was listening to it. Yeah,
so you've listened to the half of the opening chapter.
I got it.
Where in the opening chapter did you arrive at?
When
you listened to it today for the first time, drove from your house to the studio today.
Not today.
When you pulled up today,
I swear to God, not today. And I'll tell you where I am. You're at the movies.
Okay.
That's where you're at in this one. You're somewhere at the movies.
Well, that narrows it down.
Well, then. Somewhere.
Oh, when I'm watching the Jim Brown movie? That's it. The Jim Brown movie. Yeah. That's the ticket. That's
1970,
the ticket.
Something like that.
You're literally describing the first three pages.
Look, man, I only go by audio. I don't know what pages mean.
You are literally describing the first three fucking pages.
Doesn't take away from the fact that I'm a genuine fan.
Okay. No, it doesn't.
And I asked good questions.
Yes, you did. Yes, you did. Yes, you did. Yes, you did.
Doesn't mean that I'm not going to read this. Exactly.
Could have been a little bit more in depth on the manuscript that I'm here to talk about, but nevertheless.
Getting roasted by Quentin at the end of this thing. All right, I will read. I now own a physical. I wrote a book too this year. Uh-huh. Can I give you a copy of it?
Yes, you may.
Will you pretend to read it?
We'll pretend to read it. As far as you know.
There you go.
Thank you very much.
6 weeks, New York Times bestseller list. Let's hope this makes it go back on.
Okay.
Also, lastly, a lot has been made. Memes, comments, you've leaned into it, you've leaned out. I don't know. A lot of people have talked about it.
I have no idea what you're going to say.
Well, I'm going to tell you. A lot has been made of, in films, the representation of beautiful women's feet. And hold on. I want to say something. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay.
I don't know if anyone's ever said it, but I'll say it.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Bert and Tom and Bert. One goes to topless while the other wears a shirt. Tom tells stories and Bert's the machine. There's not a chance in hell that they'll keep it clean. Here's what we call Two Bears, One Cave. No scripts, a bit of booze, amateur partology. Dirty jokes, raunchy humor, no apologies. Here's what we call Two Bears, One Cave.